of which are 8 years old or more, that's a fair question. The assembled group of people have got history. They can tell you what they like and what they don't like. It's good and it's bad. Very bad. But to take a single human being called Mel, to ask him to make the decision for you on a used piece of equipment is not very fair. He may not have history with that particular one. But on brand new pieces of equipment where none of us have any history yet, all we've got is the manufacturer's spec sheet and a price list and a catalog for a new piece of equipment. Very unfair question. It's sort of like saying the Ford Motor Company just came out with model so-and-so, General Motors just came out with so-and-so, which one's the best one? Well, if my name was Consumers Union and I had just done a survey, yeah, that's sort of a fair question. We're not Consumers Union. We don't write the Consumers Report. Repeater, timeout. These are unfair questions. As I keep repeating, if you write in a question to Mel, there's a high probability he should not be answering them. It's not what we promised. We've only promised to amize verbal questions. Mel is trying to help out these guys, and he feels sorry, and he wants to be an Elmer, and he has volunteered to try to answer written questions. I think a significant people are abusing that privilege. It is not a right. It is a privilege. Just like all of ham radio is not a right. It's a privilege. You may have some opinions on this one, Mel. The other guy is being victimized by it. I think we should re-emphasize almost every TechNet for the next couple of months what is unfair as a write-in question. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Well, you know, I don't say unfair, and I'm not going to say it's unreasonable. You know, I can understand that, as you always say to Chad, that when you first hear it, it's a little bit hard to comprehend a lot of our discussion. No doubt. And I especially know when young people, I was once in that position, and I know sometimes I was really mistreated by the so-called Elmers. Some of them were not really Elmers. Some of them were pretty, I'll put the word nasty would be better to categorize them. I won't go into it, I mean, because I don't want to get upset about, you know, past things so many years ago to begin with. But when it comes to, you know, a lot of this equipment, new equipment, you know, there's a lot of it on the market. Should I buy new? Should I buy new? What price do you think I should pay? And on and on and on. I can understand that. If it was a friend of mine standing here with me and saying, gee, I got my ham light. What should I do, Bill? What do you think? What do you think of this? Is it reasonable to buy this second hand for this price and all? I guess I would have voiced an opinion, Dick. This is what I'm trying to bring out. And you don't realize many cases we have a tremendous audience that is not calling in here on the repeater, on the Linemark facility here. They are listening on scanners. They're listening on Andy Talkie and whatnot. I would say our audience that's listening is much larger than has ever joined us here verbally, over.
Yeah, from time to time, I do see evidence of that. I mean, you and I got on it. I got on a pure question subject one day of the proper adjustment of an oil burner. And all of a sudden, seven experts came out of the woodwork that we rarely had ever heard from. And gave us all kinds of information on that. That was a pretty strong piece of evidence. And by the way, this week, I may have mentioned it already, the state of Connecticut has said that they've got excess in their coffers, that they're running positives on their budget, and they're going to use some of that budget to help people replace inefficient oil burners. My goodness, is that misplaced effort. There is no such thing as an inefficient oil burner. There's an inefficient setting of the oil burner. Inefficient maintenance. The wrong size nozzle. The wrong fuel-to-air ratio. A sooty flame. A leaking system where the leaks haven't been properly sealed. Where the chimney's not clean enough. And whatever. Properly maintained. When you completely combust that oil, you're going to get that number of BTU out of it. Period. It's like saying that I've got this quartz heater that's going to heat my room, and I'm going to buy the one that's 100% efficient. Or I'm using a 100-watt light bulb to heat the room. I'm going to get 100% efficiency. I have no choice. Every watt you put into that light bulb is being turned into light and heat, and even the light hits the wall and turns into heat. Except for the little bit of light that goes out the window, it has to run at 100% efficiency. It has no choice. An oil burner that's properly running is 100% efficient on burning that oil. When you burn that oil with 100% efficiency, you get that heat. And as long as your heat exchanger is sufficiently clean and not coked up with a whole lot of thick black soot from improper setting before, which acts as an insulator, then that heat gets transferred to your water and it heats your house. So that money should be spent making a training class so that people know how to do it. It's not rocket science. It's a simple piece of hardware that you can maintain yourself. And to buy these contracts for a couple hundred dollars that guarantee inefficient setting and high prices after that, boy, I'm amazed about that, as well as credit cards, that people will run up such huge amounts of debt and a credit card and pay 20-some-odd% interest on it. A few years ago, that was called a loan shark. Now it's the big banks that are doing it. How in the world do people get sucked into that just because everyone else is doing it? I'm on one of my hobby horses. Sorry about that. K2KDY, K2LIW.
I'm not at all, Vic. This is
K2KDY.
You well imagine, you know, what the situation is. Again, here we go. A lot of things get started just like in ham radio. This understanding of the technology, and all of a sudden it becomes gospel. And like you say, you tune on to 75 meters at night. I don't contradict very few because I don't want to start something at 12:30 or whatever at night. But you want to hear some of the nonsense that is put forward. It's unbelievable. So I don't expect it to be any different in many different other aspects of our society, whether it be, you know, the gasoline situation, how to drive the car. There was a couple on how to drive your car and get extremely good gas mileage on it. One of the suggestions, believe it or not, is when you come to a traffic light, let's say, you know, it just turns red, to shut the engine off. Can you imagine that? Over.
If you're idling a vehicle outside of a building while you take an hour to unload the vehicle because you're doing a delivery, and you're going to let it sit there and idle for a solid hour, without a doubt, turn it off. But for the few seconds, for the 30 seconds you're at a traffic light, to turn off your vehicle and restart it, boy, you're going to run up, you're going to burn up that starter motor real fast. There's only a certain number of cycles you can use that starter motor for. It's a 2-volt motor, fed 12 volts. You get a tremendous amount of energy out of it for very brief periods of time. You run that starter motor for 100 seconds continuously because you've got a very hard starting automobile and you've got a really healthy battery that can do that. There's a 50-50 chance you just smoked that starter motor and it'll never run again. So to run it that frequently every time you stop at a light, that's preposterous. K2KUY, K2LAW.
Roger. Except now they are coming up with a car, I understand, next year. I don't know who's introducing it. Would you believe they have an engine that will start without a starter motor, Dick? I saw this. I didn't believe it. Certainly the New York Times in the auto review, I get the Sunday Times, and I love the Sunday Times. You know, they got the section on automobiles, real estate, the business review, all the different sections and everything. So It's very interesting to go through it, each section individually. And they have a car now that supposedly this is going to be one of the idyllic situations that when you stop for a traffic light, that the engine can be actually set to shut off some way, or it hits the button, goes off, and then when you're ready to go, you can hit the button again. But it doesn't employ a starter motor. And they're going to try to market this, I understand, for mostly city taxi cabs, believe it or not, to take over.
Okay, hybrid automobiles use this concept now. In the case of a hybrid automobile, where you want a 150 horsepower engine, and you've got 150 horsepower by way of the electric motors at each of the four wheels being fed by batteries, but you've got this tiny little motor that turns out 10 horsepower, which is continuously charging the battery, and you're using dynamic braking instead of taking all that beautiful kinetic energy and get up to 50 miles an hour and then hit the brakes, and there's a heating up brake drum or brake disc. You run your motors at the wheels backwards as generators, and they pump electricity back into the battery. And that kind of a system, with a very small horsepower motor and an efficient starter motor to keep starting and stopping it, makes sense. It's designed for that kind of a service. But take your 150 horsepower engine and a tiny little starter motor, and every time you go to a red light or a stoplight in the city, you're going to turn off the motor. That's preposterous. So there are places where that kind of a concept can be made to work. A buddy of mine used to have an old automobile where he would make sure that every time he turned it off, that the motor stopped in a particular position, and that there's gas in the cylinders, such that a gas mixture in the cylinder. So when he comes back the next morning, he would operate the spark advanced lever that used to be on these old cars, such that he would force that particular cylinder fire, and most of the time the engine would start without using the starter motor. So there are concepts that can do that. What is the method of starting without a starter motor, Mel? Go ahead.
You just hit it. I believe that's how they described it, that the engine automatically stops in a certain position with a charge in there, and when the ignition forces that piston down, the engine will start. I believe that's exactly how they described it, Dick, over.
Crafty idea. And so, and I can think of ways of building a starter motor, which really is sort of like an alternator backwards, which runs on low current footprint. See, the real wear portion of a starter motor, two things. One, the windings can't run very long without overheating, because again, it's a 2-volt motor being fed 12 volts. So in very brief periods, you can get a lot of power out of it. But don't try to do it for very long. And if you rewire it in such a way that you're not pouring 150 amperes through brushes into a commutator, that's what's going on with your starter motor right now. And those brushes have a finite amount of time that they'll do that before you wear them down. It's a very heavy-duty service. So I can think of methods of redesigning the starter motor such that it's made for that service where you use it very frequently. But even there, that throw-out bearing that takes that pinion of the starter motor and throws it into the main flywheel, engages it, and then pushes that flywheel, there's only a certain number of cycles you can do that before you start chewing up those teeth. So it's going to take some redesign in order to make this work well, but I think it can be made to work. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Roger, I believe the way they describe it, no starter motor is going to be involved at all in a car. They have a lot of new concepts, of course. Greatly, you know, improved battery situations and things. Of course, General Motors is telling about the car that's going to come out, I think, in 2010, called the Volt, V-O-L-T, which is going to be basically an electric car, a high-performance Chevrolet electric car that will give you up to 50 miles on a charge. So if you're doing up to 50 miles a day riding, at night when you come home, you plug it in, and it will charge, you know, in your backyard, in your garage, or you go to work somewhere. A lot of places said that people that work for these companies, they will provide outlets for them to plug it in. And let's say if they have to go from maybe possibly up close to 50 miles in one direction to get to work, how are they going to get back? Well, they'll provide them with an outlet to plug in and to charge the battery while they're working at 8 hours a day. So this is all kinds of concepts. And all what'll really happen, I don't know. Right now, the problem with the General Motors car is, believe it or not, they don't have the battery for it at this point, over.
Yeah, the one thing that bothers me about an electric vehicle is that they tend to get numbers like 50 and 75 miles of range, and I've become very used to a car that'll go 400 and some odd miles on a tank full of gas, and almost any other fuel is not going to give me that range. And I dread the idea of going to a gas station every 100 miles or every 50 miles. That would be a pain in the tail. And batteries that will get you 75 miles of range, there's a lot of pounds of battery with a lot of nasty stuff inside. And to protect you from that nasty stuff in the case of an accident, when the case gets broken open, I mean, you get the most amount of charge per dollar out of lead-acid batteries, but that sulfuric acid spraying around during an accident doesn't sound pleasant. Yeah, correspondingly, I can say the gasoline being sprayed around in an accident doesn't sound pleasant. But it seems like we've come a long way in making tanks that are reasonably accident-proof. Not perfect, but reasonably so. You hear very few accidents where the gas tank bursts open and sprays gas all over the place. It happens, but it's relatively rare. But the batteries, no matter whether they be lithium or lead acid or any of the other technologies, there's some fairly nasty stuff inside of those batteries, and an awful lot of pounds of batteries have to be stuffed somewhere in that automobile. So electric car is a tough way to go. I'd like to believe that right over the horizon, somebody's going to invent a really great battery that looks the size of an old lantern battery. And powers your automobile. I don't think that's so likely. Storing electricity is very tough. K2KEY, K2LAW.
K2QAQ.
Go ahead, Glenn. I hope you got the solution.
I do, but it's very expensive. No, just kidding, Vic. Actually, I have a slightly different question, if you don't mind me answering this. I was reading something pretty recently about Lindenhurst's cell phone powers, and that town of Lindenhurst is putting up, I think, some kind of a complaint about a cell phone tower, and I know that you had some input on some cell phone tower complaints. I was wondering if you had heard anything about it, or maybe could shed some information and light on it. I thought a lot of that was kind of settled already, and now it looks like it's starting all over again in Lindenhurst.
I haven't specifically heard about the Lindenhurst case, but I've been directly involved in the case in Bayville. And I know this is a similar case in Old Beth Page and Hicksville. Bayville is the strongest one right now that I know of. Bayville has roughly 250 homes in that, I think it's an incorporated village, part of Oyster Bay Township. And essentially all of the residents of each of the 250 homes have agreed to band their resources together. They've hired multiple attorneys to sue the town to remove all antennas from that town. That includes cell phone, fire, police, ambulance services. They want all of those antennas removed from the town. Their intention is good. They believe they're protecting their children. They believe that the antennas that are located on the water tower, that is 200 feet of ground distance range from the grade school. They have blamed the antennas on that water tower for creating what they think is a cancer cluster. One student in the school and one faculty member in the school did acquire cancer. And so the town's residents have said, "My mind is made up. Don't confuse me with any more facts. Those antennas are doing it. I don't care where you put them. I don't care what the residents of the other town are going to have to suffer. You're going to move those antennas into some other town. That's essentially what they're saying. And I've tried to calm that situation. I've had no success. It's a real uphill battle. And so, let me drop.
Yay, Romania got the golden...
It's a real uphill battle because each of the people in the town are afraid to fight the major opinion of the town for fear that they'd be unaccepted with their neighbors and friends. So that's the strongest case I know of. And the fact that that has spread to other places doesn't surprise me. The major problem is a vocabulary problem, the word radiation, RF radiation. Had we been smart enough in the early days to call it RF transmission, RF signaling, wireless transmission, any other combination of words wouldn't have created this problem. RF energy, unless you do some really crazy things, it's safe as all hell. But because it's got the word radiation, I mean, there was a person who asked me the question of, when I take my food out of a microwave oven, how long should I wait for the food, for the radiation of the food to die down so that the food is safe to eat? And the answer is 1 nanosecond. The very last cycle of the 2 gigahertz, when the magnetron tube turns off, the RF energy in the piece of hamburger you're cooking is gone. When the very last cycle of the magnetron comes out, that's when it's gone. There are people who believe you take the hamburger out of the microwave oven, set it on the table for 10 minutes to wait for the radiation to die down so it's safe to eat the food. The vocabulary misunderstanding here, as you can see, is huge. And the particular person who asked me that question is a person with a master's degree, not in electrical engineering, but a fairly well-educated person, misunderstanding the concept. So you're going to be hearing more and more of this. It's not going to go away. Communication Act of 1990-something or other, that the federal government has said, you can no longer deny the sighting of a cell phone base station based on the perceived radio frequency biohazard risk. That is no longer an issue with our federal government. You can deny the sighting because you think it's going to affect property values. It's a tough road to hoe, but you can do it, you can try it. Or in some communities, you can deny it because you think that there's an endangered species under that antenna. This particular insect that you're going to be affecting his lifestyle. You think I'm laughing at that one? I'm not. That's a serious case. It is taking place on Long Island. So it's a strong misunderstanding. It's a technical lack of understanding of how the thing really works. You get 1 million times more radio energy into your body when you use a cell phone. I'm not saying a cell phone is unsafe. But the cell phone against your head, because of the closeness.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
1 million times more energy when that cell phone is against your head, as opposed to your house being located directly next door to a cell phone base station. A cell phone base station is a 100-foot high tower, great big chunk of hardware, looks dangerous as all hell. But because of the inverse square law, the distance between that antenna and your body and the pattern of that antenna, you get 1 million times less energy directly next door to the cell phone base station as opposed to putting the thing against your head. You ask the average person, would he allow the cell phone base station to be constructed next to his house? He would say, not in my backyard. That's called NIMBY, N-I-M-B-Y, not in my backyard, because it's unsafe. Good sounding common sense, dead wrong. So, back to you, Glenn. I haven't heard about Linda Paris, but are they trying to remove antennas from that town also? You got it, Glenn.
I have a comment then, Glenn.
And then you, right after Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. I mean, what you're saying is 100% right on the money. It's just a matter of that, I guess, people just don't understand radio and how it works, RF energy, and what's involved in, comparison to you know, heavy radiation like uranium and other things like that that affect the body in one X-ray, and just going in to have your teeth X-ray, what are they going to do next? I mean, the lack of understanding is just so off the scale. I mean, when they bring a child in for an X-ray for their teeth, you know, to have their teeth checked once a year or twice a year, and they're going to have X-rays taken, they're subjected to heavy radiation particles that stick with their child for a while, and RF radiation has none of those properties whatsoever. And here now, in Lindenhurst, there's a cell tower that's basically a flagpole, you know, covering the cellular apparatus underneath of it. And the people, the residents of that town, want that tower removed from that park. And it's like you're saying, it's causing everyone cancer, it's radiation, and it's going to, you know, kill everybody. It's the craziest thing. And I'm just surprised that, you know, that there isn't a large enough standing, especially because of, you remove the cell phones, you start emergency communication. It's almost insane. Back to you, K2RI, W2QIQ.
K2YY.
Okay, dude.
Okay, I'm going to pick up Alex, Joe, and Eric in that order. One further comment I wanted to make, and that is, I forgot it. Oh, boy. Alex, I better turn it over to you. N2NNU, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thank you. Listen, my personal opinion is that we are tinkering with something that we don't really understand. We do not really need to know what RF radiation is, if radiation is, putting quotation marks. Maxwell and all those guys with the physics and mathematics tells us that is the field of electrical and magnetics, whatever. But when you ask them what is the field, they shrugging their head, well, it's an abstract notion. How can an abstract notion introduce electricity in a wire 10,000 miles away, I ask? Well, we don't know really that. So the basic question is, I think, we are radiating from an antenna. Radiation means loss of mass. We're radiating electrons, or we're radiating magnetic fields. We're radiating something. We're getting out energy and mass out of this antenna. Where is that coming from? Who is losing the mass? The physicians will tell, well, we are not really losing really the mass. It's just transformed in a different form. But that's not true. Because once this mass, energy, or whatever you call it, Einstein, if you will, it goes out into the far space, way away from the Earth, and Earth lost some mass. The best basic question of mine is, where is this mass coming from? Back to you, Dick.
You bet. That's a nice, deep question, Alex, for which there's no good, simple answer. I'm pumping electrons into that antenna with my transmitter. The electrons bounce back and forth with resonance, creates a current. The current creates a magnetic field. The magnetic field does do the radiating. That's what the signal really is. I'm oversimplifying, but that's the closest I can come to it. It's not actually electrons coming out of the antenna. It's a magnetic field. The American National Standards Institute, on the so-called C95 study, 50 years of study of the radio frequency biohazard capability of RF energy. 50 years of study, 450 references, our best institutions, our best testing laboratories, they have not found any non-thermal effects. RF energy, when it hits a human being, creates heating. As long as that amount of heating is kept small enough, no effect, no permanent effect, and maybe not even any temporary effect takes place. As long as you stay below the maximum permitted exposure, MPE. So there's a lot of documentation on this. That document gets boiled into the equivalent for the Department of Defense, for NIOSH, for OSHA, for the Consumers Report, all of those. So there's a lot of history in the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, the European countries have a similar study. They all come to very similar conclusions. RF energy, within reason, is extremely safe. nothing is perfectly safe. Let me drop. There's a degree of risk in everything you do. There's a degree of risk of you stepping in front of that rig and squeezing that push-to-talk microphone. There's certainly a significant risk when you climb into that automobile to drive to work tomorrow morning. As long as the risk-to-benefit ratio is high enough, we're willing to accept that risk. 40,000 people per year die in automobiles. We do our best to make automobiles safe and make highways safe. We don't outlaw automobiles. 100,000 people per year supposedly die because of missed medication in hospitals in the United States. And we're working on techniques to make sure that missed medication doesn't take place, that accidents don't take place. There's risk everywhere. The risk from radio energy is so small compared to the benefit that in the case of Bayville, the Department of Homeland Security has gone on record to say that if that community succeeds in winning that lawsuit and removing those antennas from that water tower, the Department of Homeland Security has basically said, we will condemn that water tower, we will declare it our possession by eminent domain, and we will put those antennas back. There will be communication in that community for fire, police, and emergency services, ambulance services, to protect life and limb, despite the fact there's a strong misunderstanding of what radio energy does in that community. That's a case that is very unlikely to be won, and a lot of money is being spent on that particular case, and it's not the only one. Joe, W2LYY, T2LIW, go ahead.
RSO with a comment.
So, caller, if the community doesn't want it, it doesn't want it. It doesn't matter if it is good or bad. The community doesn't want it, and that's that. This is America. It's not Russia or China.
There are certain things the Department of Homeland Security says you will have by federal law. It's almost like Russia in that one particular case. The benefit of life and limb, I can declare the number of people who will die in that community because of a lack of emergency services if those antennas are removed. You and I could come up with some reasonably traceable statistics as to how many people will die. And the federal government is not going to allow you to murder those people. I'm using slightly strong language here. Joe, we'll get to each one of you guys. Hang in there. Joe first.
I'm moving back to Russia.
Is any of the meetings you've ever been to, and only you would probably bring up these terms yourself, have you ever heard these two terms mentioned at any of these meetings? Ionizing and non-ionizing radiation.
At every meeting I have been present at, those words were spoken by me. Realistically, I'm having trouble believing that 50% of the audience understood it, no matter how carefully I tried to explain it. Back to you, Joe.
Yeah, okay. I thought I was being stepped on by somebody else. You ought to wait for courtesy, tell you.
RSO with a comment.
Okay, yeah. You got Eric in front of you. KE2EJ and then RSO in that order. Go ahead, Eric.
No, I just want to point out a couple of things. That biological beings have sensitivity to magnetism. For example, whales and dolphins use magnetism, very weak magnetic fields to navigate. So there is sensitivity in terms of a cellular device based on nucleus and protoplasm and actually a little bit of hemoglobin, which is iron. But, yeah, that's besides the point. And the thermal effects of non-ionizing radiation is pretty well known. And there are some pretty strict rules about how much you can put in a public area. As long as you exceed those values, you know, if you're within those values, there's, in essence, no possibility of anything happening. But one of these days, these politicians will wake up and say, look, based on current scientific evidence that what you guys want really doesn't seem possible, but we'll give you the benefit of the doubt. not only will we remove those antennas, but since that cell phone that you have is a million times more powerful, and that we can consider that dangerous as a gun. So therefore, in this town, it will be illegal to have cell phones and transmitters that you can hold in your hand. And, you know, you want that enacted? We'll enact it. And maybe that will bring some reason to people, but I doubt that would do it. But there is an effective counter because, okay, we believe you, therefore what you have is even worse. You can't have it.
There is a solution for a person who feels strongly enough about this. I'll admit this is extreme. But if you really feel that this technology called cell phones and two-way radios used by police and fire and ambulance operators and whatever, if you really feel that they're dangerous and interfering with your lifestyle, a drastic solution would be to go back to a simpler lifestyle. As long as you have the right kind of morality, the people in the Amish people and the Mennonite people in Pennsylvania will welcome you with open arms. You can live with them. You can live without all of these appliances. You can go back to a much simpler lifestyle. And some people almost want to do that. But for the majority of society, which has accepted modern technology 98% of the time, if you're going to be part of that society, you have to kind of go along with it. It's become a way of life. We've got beautiful communication services in the case of radio and television. Are we going to outlaw television broadcast stations? Are we going to outlaw the local oscillators that are in the receivers? You can see where we go here. You can't... This particular cat is out of the bag. We just can't get enough wireless services. We want the capabilities that wireless gives us. Nothing is perfectly safe, but the risk to benefit ratio here, in my mind, is so high that to deny accepting that benefit is very, very foolish and uninformed, but that's my opinion. I'll admit that everyone's going to believe that. Now, Frank is going to straighten us all out on this. N2RSL, go right ahead, sir. K2RIW in the tech net.
Just wondering, what's so great about television?
What's so great about, I think you said civilization? Oh, give me that word again, Alex.
I meant television. What's so great about television? It's just a great wasteland. I don't know. If it wouldn't be me, if I wouldn't be a president, I would turn off all the TVs in the nation. You'll see how much time you gain and how much more productive you can be.
I hear you. When it comes to soap operas, I think you're right. If you watch the right kind of educational programming, I think I'm getting a lot of benefit from it. But I may be wrong. Frank, in 2 hours, go right ahead.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Maybe I've been watching too many law or legal shows on TV, but my opinion is this. If I were the judge in this case, I would rule the town as being arbitrary and capricious. It's analogous to a town, city, or a state asking the federal government to remove the GPS satellites and take them out of the geosynchronous orbit because they are inundating their town or village or state with radiation. How's that for an answer?
Hey, Nick? Yeah, that's a beauty, Frank. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, okay. Two things. One, interestingly enough, and I don't remember which university it was, but they did a survey of the health of the transmitter operators around the country in the 70s and the 80s. I got to find it. It's interesting because it does show that an awful lot of transmitter operators came down with various different kinds of cancers in their life. So that's an interesting point. But, I think I just lost it. Yeah, I lost it.
Okay, back here.
ABC2 QAQ.
You'll get it back, Eric. Go ahead, Glenn.
Just a quick statement. Yeah, I'm familiar with some of those studies about where people who work in technologies and technicians, assembly people in electronics companies, people who work in certain technologies, that there are definitely higher levels of cancer rates. And I think the majority of that has already been answered, like in the late 80s and early 90s, by many of the chemicals that were being used in facilities and around electronics, most of which have already been banned. And that was just, you know, strictly trichlor, ethyl methylene, some of those cleaning agents. They caused a tremendous amount of health-related issues and other things. And the fact that they've removed a tremendous amount of it has done that. And then there again, that's another reason why the lead is looking at being brought out of a lot of that industry. So some of those direct relationships with this thing, well, because they were a transmitter operator that they had, you know, that's not necessarily because there are many other things that went, you know, along with that as well. K4IWP2QIQ.
I had a microwave reflector submittal that I made. This is a listserv of serious microwave operators throughout the world. And I submitted a five-page report, like a four-page report, about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, in which I proposed a hypothetical situation along the lines of this risk-to-benefit ratio in everything we do. I'm a guy who owns 100 feet of radio tower. Without a doubt, I've taken some significant risk to, with my own muscle power, assemble that tower, maintain the antennas that are on it, and so on. I think I'm getting a lot of benefit with the distances I can talk and the amount of bragging I can do about it. But yes, I've accepted that risk. The hypothetical situation, I said, let me drop. Let's assume that some very well-equipped organization, laboratory, testing facility came to the conclusion that your hobby of ham radio throughout your lifetime, by the time you reach 70 years of age, is going to lower your IQ by 1 point. Would you still become a ham radio operator? It is my belief that the majority of us would say yes. We'd say about three or four reasons we'd rationalize it. One, I love the hobby. I don't want to give it up. Number two, I'm lucky. It's not going to happen to me. Number three, I'll become a QRP operator so that now my IQ will only go down 0.01% instead of 1%. There's all kinds of... And number four, the Stanford-Binet test by which you measure the IQ is very flawed, so therefore the data is not accurate. Number five, when they came to that conclusion, there wasn't a large enough data set, therefore the evidence it got is not statistically significant. We use all of those excuses, rationalizations. The majority of us, 75-80% of us, would still go right on with our ham radio. We'd say, I'm willing to accept that risk. Because even if the evidence was accurate, how do you know that the RF energy is the causative agent? We amateur radio operators are curious people. We do a lot of funny things. We have all smelled the lead fumes from the soldering and the flux of the soldering. We have all been exposed to the cleaning fluids that are used for removing the flux from our printed circuit boards. We've been around all kinds of electronics that's outgassing. We're in high technology laboratories that have got the wall-to-wall rugs in some cases, and tiles on the floor that's outgassing all kinds of chemicals. Are you sure the RF energy is the causative agent? Very tough. There is probably nothing on planet Earth more complicated than the problem of trying to assess the IQ of a single human being versus all of the possible exposures. Very complicated situation. We'll never have all the data on that one. The best we can do, let me drop.
I have a comment again.
And Alex is going to get a chance in a second. The best we can do is discuss it as we are right now. Read the best literature on the subject. Discuss it. In every situation, there is a risk-to-benefit ratio. A prudent man does all he can to minimize the risk, and then he proceeds with the activity if it's of great enough desirability to him. That radio tower, 100 foot high, puts me at a lot of risk. I want the benefit I get out of it. I wear not one, but two safety harnesses when I climb that tower. I have a radio strapped to my chest by which I can holler Mayday if I get myself in trouble. I haven't eliminated the risk. I've lowered it an amount that to me is acceptable, and I proceed with the activity. That's the way you act in almost everything in life. That automobile is dangerous as all hell. 40,000 people die violently in that automobile. If you're smart, you take defensive driving courses. You wear the seatbelt. You make sure there's not big heavy objects in the car that are capable of smacking you in the head on the back in the case of an accident, and so on. You take prudent applications of good common sense to lower the risk. But if I had to walk or ride a bicycle to all the places I go every week, I would really be hampered. I want to use that automobile. I'm willing to accept that risk, even though it's darn significant. All of life is like that. Alex, hang in there. Don't go back to Russia. N2NNU, KQRIW.
Before I came back.
Okay, right after Alex. Go ahead, Alex.
Well, that statement was rhetorical because I think that we're still living in a free society. If my community decides we don't want cellular phones in our neighborhood, that's fine with me. You know, that's the community speaking, and that's the majority, voice of the majority. This is what makes America what it is. If the government tries to impose something under the umbrella of our protection, this is no more America. Anyhow, that's another story. Related to the IQ loss of one point, you forgot to mention the fifth case, which is pertinent to me. I really don't care if I lose a point because I have 180. So what is 180 or 179? Second point is, you said that we are good radio amateurs are exposed to other hazards like the smoke of the solder and all kinds of chemicals we're working. I think you are mistaken here. 80% of all radio amateurs never soldered once in their time. They are buying a radio, they're pushing the on button, and they're spitting 8 hours in the mic. That's why they're calling us radio amateurs. I made my point. Dick, back to you.
Yes, you did. And I've got a question for you, Alex. Is there something about the water, the food, the people? What is it in Yonkers that gave Alex an IQ of 180? And what have I got to do to get some of that?
Well, you have to be born in Romania and live there for some period of time. All smart people come from Romania.
Okay, my heritage came from Prague. Is that close enough?
So you will be 160. That's fine.
Yeah, I came from the same place that that Tesla came from. I hope it rubs off. Go ahead, Eric. K3EJ, K2RIW. We're having some fun here.
I thought Tesla was a Yugoslavian, a Serb, actually.
Maybe you're right. Eric, you got it.
All right, thing that I wanted to point out that I remember now, let's see, 2001, when the World Trade Center came down, and all its broadcasters moved over to the Armstrong Tower at Alpine, all of a sudden there became a Alpine Tower Group, which interestingly enough, was comprised of the CEO and head of Time Warner and a few other large companies, because, you know, it's the blues of housing there. And, they fought like heck to get the broadcasters out of there, to, you know, because they're going to add another 100 feet to the top of it. They were all complaining about that. And actually, the state court sided with them, but the Supreme Court and the FCC and Homeland Security didn't exist at that point. They basically said that this is, you know, national security, and you know, what you guys want to do is like, it's just too bad. So broadcast stations have a certain amount of built-in protection.
Are you saying, and I think you're saying, that the FCC, which used to have some pretty tight rules that were restrictive to broadcast, now the federal government, by way of Homeland Security and whatever, is defending broadcast and guaranteeing that we will have it, is almost, is that what you're saying, Eric? It sounds good to me.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Even the state said, now we agree with the local group, and it got to the FCC and the Supreme Court, and they said,
It's all because of Sesame Street. The federal government is guaranteeing that my grandchildren will have the ability to watch Sesame Street and watch Nova and watch nature and so on. That's what it is. I'm exaggerating. Boy, we got on a hot subject, but there's got to be at least somebody else out there that wants to make a comment, jokingly or real. We got to put some humor into this. This is heavy stuff. Anyone want to make a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. KQLIW in the deck, man. Wow. Hey, Mel. You're back in command. KQKEY, KQLIW.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. There's got a lot of controversy going back and forth on radio and radiation and all that. I always said that was the worst word that ever was put in that. Communication was the word radiation. And you made a funny remark with that, with the microwaves and all. I made a facetious remark at a couple of times that we've had dinner parties and all. And I said that also, that question was asked about, to me about, when is it safe after you take the stuff out of the microwave oven? I said, well, what we do at home, I turn the lights off, and if I don't see it glowing, and when it stops glowing, we eat it. And you know something, Dick? People look at this and say, gee, that's a wonderful idea. That sounds like that's the ideal answer to the problem. So, again, there we go. You know, I made a facetious joke, you know, a tongue-in-cheek joke, as they say, and people took it as the gospel. I will bet some of those people at that party that listened, I'll bet you they went home and they're doing it. I wouldn't be surprised.